Bucks Pocket to the shores of Orange Beach and all points in between. An insider's perspective on Alabama politics. It's the Jeff Poor Show.
I don't think Hank done it this way.
And welcome back to the Jeff Poor Show at FM Talk 106.5. Happy Friday morning to you. 6 minutes after the hour, still to come on the program. State Senator Chris Elliott will be with us. That's in the next, that's at the bottom of the hour, so make sure you stay tuned for that. But join us on the line now, a friend of mine. I had him on frequently back in my Huntsville days. Getting him on here in Mobile for the first time. Represents part of Tennessee. Congressman Scott DeJarlais joins us. Congressman, how are you this morning?
Doing great, Jeff. Good to be with you again.
Hey, as always, thanks for making time for us. Well, first off, how are things going with COVID-19? Your district, your family is that things look seem to be looking up?
Yeah, I think we're doing well here in Tennessee, and I think the COVID deaths are starting to taper off again. You know, certainly we've had a large increase of testing worldwide or nationwide, and we're up to almost 74 million tests in this country, about 25% of our population. So even though you hear commentary how the U.S. leads in deaths and leads in COVID cases, that would probably change if other countries would test even close to what we do. But I feel like from my physician perspective, which, as you know, I did 20 years before coming to Congress, I feel like we're getting a handle on this. We're treating it better. We know who we need to protect, and we need to continue hand washing. The mask, I'm a little bit of a skeptic on, but I think it does remind people to be careful. And overall, I think that we're going to see a decline in COVID cases and COVID deaths moving into the fall. We're going to learn to live with this, and we're going to learn an awful lot from it. And hopefully we can handle something like this next time something comes around that's new.
Right. And then, all the social distancing and, like you said, the mask, the hot spots don't seem to be, we're not seeing as many hot spots flare up like we were earlier in the summer, at least not yet. Now, whether that's a product of the mask or not, that remains to be seen. But just from a standpoint of numbers, it does seem to be going in a better direction.
We'll see. I was in Sturgis, which is where I grew up, out in South Dakota. They had their annual bike rally, and now I see numbers between 360 and 460,000 bikers were in attendance for 10 days. And I was at my mother and sister's place. We had about 100 bikers stay with us, and certainly downtown masks were an anomaly. People really seemed to cut loose, enjoy themselves, and so far they've reported under 25 cases of COVID. And, as we get into things like football season, you wonder what the things to do are in terms of being around crowds. We'll see as the data comes in from Sturgis, but those people come literally from all over the country. And if the numbers stay low, they'll also test the community there to see whether there was any cases generated because of all the visitors. And so I'm interested to see here in a week or two how that shakes out.
How optimistic are you about football season? SEC's full speed ahead with it. I know there's probably a lot of Tennessee fans in your district looking forward to the football season. Does that seem like it's going to work the way the conference wants it to?
I don't know. I mean, we look forward to it except for the Alabama game. But I think they're going to have, reduced 25% fans in the stadium, the players. I think they need to play. They're the younger, healthier population. They're not the high-risk population. We know that those are 65, 75, 85, and older with comorbidities. 81% of deaths occur in these age groups with comorbidities. So younger, healthier people who get COVID tend to either be asymptomatic or have less than probably typical flu-like symptoms. So I definitely think we need our kids in school. We need kids in the colleges. There's all kinds of studies showing how helpful that is and how harmful it is for them not to participate in this. So I think for the athletes, they're great physical specimens. I think we can safely play football. It won't probably be like a typical season, but maybe something's better than nothing.
I mean, do you get the sense some of this is political, though, that we need to not go down this road? Why risk it? That we're just in such a politicized time, particularly with the presidential election coming up, that maybe we're exaggerating the threats of this to college age kids or even younger than that, perhaps.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the numbers in school age kids 0 to 17, I think there's been 37 or 38 COVID deaths nationwide. In the same time period, influenza, other respiratory illnesses have killed 500 to 600. So that happens year in and year out, and we just live with that. We don't talk about it. We don't politicize it. So if you purely just study the numbers, these age groups are relatively safe. Now, of course, there's a question, do they transmit it to parents and grandparents when they bring it home? But the same social distancing we do everywhere else, hand washing is the most important factor, but masks, we can still be careful. I think we can do both, and I think it absolutely is politicized. I think November 3rd, November 4th, COVID will almost be an afterthought. So I hate the politics, and also we've always been a litigious society, which just seems to get worse. So I'm sure colleges and other institutions are concerned about getting sued if they go forward against some of the guidelines that have been put out there, even though they tend to defy common sense.
I mean, that seems to be one of the things that we talk a lot about, a vaccination or a vaccine for COVID-19, but really you're going to need some kind of protection. Part of that kind of a two-pronged approach would be liability protection for businesses and other institutions. That's going to have to be a part of it. Do you think it should be done at the federal level or at the state level?
Well, I mean, I always like to do more things at the state level that we possibly can, but liability protection is something we've been looking at in Congress, and we're going back tomorrow to vote against this new conspiracy theory that Pelosi's come up with and Schumer, that somehow Trump is trying to undermine the election through the Postal Service, and maybe we'll talk about that more in a bit. But, we've got to deal with liability, I think, and this is not the first virus we've dealt with. There's been Ebola, there's been swine flu, and then there's seasonal flu, which takes the lives worldwide of 600,000 people every year worldwide, and there's usually 30, 40, 50 million cases, more so than we've had with COVID, and we just accept that because it's a known entity. COVID's unknown, so it's a little scarier, but we have a vaccine for flu, and we still accept those deaths. We'll have a vaccine for COVID here shortly. There's 170 vaccines in the works, and there's actually 7 in phase 3, which is a step before release, and 15 in phase 2. So I don't have any doubt that we'll have a vaccine. Now, I don't know who all will take it. I think the elderly should take it. I'm 56. I don't think, as a physician right now, I would probably take it or have my family who's younger take it. But I hope we don't see a mandated vaccine, but there will be a vaccine, and this will become I'm not going to say just another flu bug, but it's kind of going to be just another flu bug once you have a vaccine. And I think the politicization of it will dampen significantly after November 3rd. And as we have a vaccine going into next year, I don't think you'll see the country shut down. I don't think you'll necessarily see masks and all that going into next year if we have a COVID outbreak along with our flu outbreaks, as long as there's vaccinations.
That seems to be like a real fight that could be shaping up politically, policy-wise. Mandate the vaccine, that everybody has to have the COVID vaccine. Sounds simple enough, but there's a lot of people that don't want to have those kinds of things mandated by the government. Do you get the sense we're heading in that direction?
Well, I've certainly heard that, and it bothers me, and I know a lot of people are balking at that. We're still supposedly a free country. It seems less and less so every day sometimes. But again, we know who the at-risk population is. Most deaths have occurred, 81% have occurred in people with comorbidities, meaning lung diseases, heart diseases, probably wouldn't have died if it was just COVID alone. So those folks, certainly, you can make a strong case for them getting the vaccine. Kids who tend to have little or no symptoms, I guess you can vaccinate them if you want. Not everyone takes the flu vaccine, and again, it kills 60,000 to 80,000 people in this country every year. And so you can choose whether you want the flu vaccine or not. Some do, some don't. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But I do think knowing what COVID has done in the elderly population and people at risk with other health problems, it'd certainly be a good idea for some of the demographics to take it.
Joined by Congressman Scott DeJarle of Tennessee's 4th Congressional District here on the Jeff Poore Show. Congressman, you mentioned it. Head back to Washington, the post office conspiracy seems to be Nancy Pelosi making a stand. We know it's a messaging tactic and that it's going nowhere in the United States Senate. Talk about that, if you would. It does seem a little too convenient for this to be the issue now.
4 years ago, we had the Russian conspiracy and collusion. There had to be an excuse. They can't lose because the people of this country actually chose President Trump. There must have been something wrong, something corrupt. So now it's kind of like when I go out to play golf. I've always got a sore shoulder or a sore back before I start, so I have an excuse for my low score. They're already teeing up the Postal Service as a phony scam where Trump's trying to suppress voters and he's trying to carry-rate the postal system so it can't handle the capacity for mail-in voting. And, you know, frankly, we've seen what happened in mail-in voting or ballot harvesting in California in the midterms. We had 6 or 7 Republican House members who had a good lead, sometimes 6-10% on election day. And through ballot harvesting, where ballots were sent out and the Democrats operatives are out picking them up and bringing them in, they counted and counted and counted until they beat all 6 of the Republicans that had a lead. So I'm sure Pelosi has a dream of implementing that scheme nationwide, and she fears that Trump somehow is trying to interfere with that. But as you look at the facts on this, the Postal Service has been underwater for years. Under the Obama administration, he removed like 14,000 of the blue mailboxes we see sitting around because they're ineffective areas. And he'd implemented changes, closed 80 post offices. And so a lot of this has been going on long before Trump. Trump hired a guy named DeJoy that was not appointed by Trump. They like to talk about him being a Republican donor. Well, most people that are in any president's cabinet of either a Democrat or Republican party tend to be aligned with that party. But this guy was picked by the Board of Governors. Trump doesn't have control over the Postal Service, and he's simply trying to make things in the Postal Service better. Because of this conspiracy, he's vowed to not make any more changes until after the election. The post office is fully funded right now through August 21st. Pelosi wants us to come back and vote for $25 billion more in funding for the post office and implement all these radical changes. But they handle like 470 million pieces of mail a day. There's 158 million voters. Most of those vote in person. So if there's even half of those vote by mail, they have more than the capacity to do this on time. And so it really is just a conspiracy theory created by the Democrats to try to undermine Trump and undermine people's confidence in the election.
I mean, you've been in the House of Representatives for almost a decade. Do you get complaints about the Postal Service? I mean, everybody kind of shrugs off the Postal Service as it being, it is what it is, but it never seemed to be on anybody's radar until about a month ago.
Yeah, no, I agree. And again, looking for excuses, trying to make excuses for why they lose other than, you know, what their own messaging problems are. We've just lived through 4 days of the Democratic Convention, and all I think I've really learned in 4 days and multiple speakers was that they all hate Trump, and that tends to be their platform, and they're going to raise taxes. But other than that, you know, there's not a single mention about the violence and rioting in Portland, Seattle, and all the things, the violence across the country that they seem to condone. You know, that's the problem, just like everything else. It wasn't mentioned. You know, I think that Biden has pretty much surrendered to the socialist agenda. And going forward, I think that we'll see people make a comparison between the Biden-Harris pick and the Trump-Pence and see who is best suited to revive the economy, which Trump had done prior to the pandemic. And frankly, the stock market and the S&P 500 hit a record this week. And so the economy looks pretty fine despite the number of people that are still out of work because of the COVID suppression. I think we can continue to reopen the country. The economy will surge back, and that's because Trump built it. The Democrats want to go in and immediately raise taxes, which we know is going to crush business. It'll chase manufacturing off. They really want to undo, and I think they flat out said it, they want to undo the policies of President Trump that were successful. So I think as we get closer and closer to the election, people are going to make those comparisons and see that there's only one clear choice to continue the country on a path for prosperity.
Carson, we've got to leave it there, but I really want to thank you for making time for us this morning.
I appreciate you having me on, Jeff.
All right, that was Congressman Scott DeJarlais of Tennessee's 4th Congressional District, a physician very aware of these issues, adds that extra expertise, I guess, if you would, when it comes to public policy. Got to get another break in here. We'll be right back. This is the Jeff Porsche Show at FM Talk 106.5.
We tell stories about what goes on in Montgomery at midnight. 'Cause music row ain't all in Tennessee. to bury me in Dixie. Song, song of the South, sweet potato pie and I shut my mouth. Gone, gone with the wind, there ain't nobody looking back again.
Welcome back to the Jeff Moore Show at FM Talk 106.5. 25 minutes after the hour, still to come on the program. In the next segment, we'll hear from State Senator Chris Elliott. He'll join us on the line. Looking forward to that. Big show planned for you Monday. Give you a little teaser here. Lee Lawson, he's the president and CEO of the Baldwin County Economic Alliance. He'll be with us. We'll also have from WVNN. You hear him on the weekends here, Alabama Politics this week. Dale Jackson will be with us. We also got State Representative Brent Easterbrook. He's filling in for Matt Simpson, who's got to step away, got some other business to take care of. But Representative Easterbrook and I got to talk about ALDOT, about roads. 45, kind of my new mission to get that four lane someday, as it seems like we've been talking about that, and Highway 98 from Mobile to the Mississippi state line. Both of those roads, two lane, all my life, and I've never understood why they've never been a priority. Up until here recently, and in these kinds of places that head off to the state line, they just seem to be not important to the people that run the highway department in the state. But what they miss is there's people along the way that live in these places that are underserved and aren't very well connected to these major metropolitan areas, to interstate highways where they need to get, and it does them a real disservice. So we'll get him on to talk about that. And then finally we'll have Congressman Bradley Byrne on from our first congressional district down here, talk about the big weekend's proceedings, the Postal Service, now the most important issue in public policy right now. I find that fascinating. How many of you woke up this morning and we're just stressed out about the post office and the way the post office is? Forget COVID. Forget civil unrest. Forget a presidential. It's the post office. So I buy stamps in advance. You got to send letters sometimes, correspondence, maybe Christmas cards, show that you still care or whatever. But I got to tell you, it's not something I personally do a whole lot of, is dealing with the mail, other than going to answer the mail. You can just about do everything now online, paying bills. I understand you still need a mail. You still need an operating mail system. We're not, who knows what could happen with technology. It's just whatever. We just need to have it. It's kind of like passenger rail. You like the idea of it. I really got into that. I know this was a big issue. It comes up from time to time about passenger rail service in Mobile. I am stridently anti-passenger rail service as it exists now, hoping we would be wiser and hold out for high-speed rail service. But passenger rail service, just something you got to have to get around the country in case something happens with the air transportation and you need to go from one place to another. Not everybody can drive, although most people can drive. But it's these institutions we keep around as a worst-case scenario, I suppose. But the post office, we keep it around. It still seems to serve a useful purpose. The funny thing is, guys, when you hear Nancy Pelosi and other Democrats talk about Donald Trump's attack on the Postal Service, it's going to keep people from getting their Social Security benefits. They always go to that. They always go to the entitlement. They always go to somebody getting a check, not going to be able to get their check. Here's a dirty little secret, guys. I don't think they have, since 2013, sent out Social Security checks, except for some very special circumstances. Most of that's done electronically. You either sit to a bank account and you draw it out electronically. No, you don't. The mail very rarely plays a role in that. You're going to get those talking points, though. You're probably going to get those talking points. Will we get any clarity on just how big of a problem this is with these hearings that are underway right now? I'm very skeptical of that. But you got to wonder, it's almost insulting to our intelligence to say that Donald Trump, part of his grand scheme is to dismantle the Postal Service so that he can get elected. The ruthless Donald Trump, authoritarian Donald Trump, it's not using the military to take over the seats of power and government. No. He's going to do it covertly through your mailbox. Does anybody believe in this, or is it just something convenient to say? Here's my belief. Not many people really believe it in their heart, but it feels good to say. It's very therapeutic. It feels good to say that he's up to no good, and that's why he gets talked about so much. And that's such a response, I think, from not just the media, but a lot of the supporters of Joe Biden, or people on the left, supporters of the Democratic Party, supporters of left-wing causes, that it makes them feel good just to say this president's a disaster. Russia, Ukraine, post office, go down the line of everything he's done wrong, and it just makes my case. He's got to get him out of office. But whether it counts, does it win you the election? I don't think so at all. All right, folks, got to take a break here. We'll be right back. This is the Jeff Poor Show on FM Talk 106.5.
Right up over Spanish Fort into Mobile, my hometown. Mr. T.
Sitting here at the Floribama, about to open up a big old can. Good times, unwind, falling and out of love in the same night.
Welcome back to the Jeff Moore Show at FM Talk 106.5. 34 minutes after the hour on this Friday morning. Joining us on the line now, our friend from Baldwin County, and my friend as well. Always a pleasure to bring him on. State Senator Chris Elliott joins us on the line. Senator, how are you this morning?
I am great. Happy Friday. Glad to be with you.
It's always marking the beginning of the end, heading into the weekend when we get you on. Everything going okay?
Things are good. Got a couple little swirly things out in the Gulf that we're watching right now. I've talked to my mayors down on the south end of the county. They're watching those pretty tightly, so it'll be probably a working weekend for most folks on the south end trying to get ready for what may be.
Yeah, there's a lot of work that goes into that. Quasi-coastal Jeff Poor here, you're thinking about the way you got to shore up everything and make sure it's ready for the worst-case scenario.
Absolutely, getting boats out of lifts and stuff off the beach and things like that. It's just things that take a day or two to get done that you really don't want to do unless you have to do, but you can get short on time if you're not careful. So it pays to go ahead and plan to do that stuff. Wait as long as you can, but at the same time, make sure you leave enough time.
But I guess over the last decade or so, we down here have gotten kind of good at that routine.
We have. If we could just, when I was on the county commission, our challenge is always to try to keep Montgomery from telling us how to do things down here, because they got no idea how to do it.
Yeah, they tend to, it's been my experience just watching, they tend to maybe react in ways that sound good, or there's an impulse, we got to do something. It's kind of like the way they're handling the COVID stuff. We need to be proactive, we need to be involved, and then you get those incidents of maybe an overreach.
My good friend Senator Sam Gavan, who I know you know very well, has a saying about that. We got to do something. He says, "Yeah, but we ain't got to do that." And that's the one I borrow from him frequently.
Senator, speaking of your Senate colleagues and all things legislature, I heard you on Sean's show earlier this week talking about the special session. Seems like the push for that's really from you guys in the Senate. Doesn't seem like there's much of an appetite, at least we know from the governor, but it doesn't seem like there's much of an appetite from the House as well. But I guess my question is, if we really put everything off till 2021, how chaotic is that going to be?
Well, I think it would be a shame to do that, first of all. I mean, let me be clear, and I think I was when I talked to Sean about this as well, but we need to go back into special session to finish up the unfinished business from the last session and to address some very pressing issues. If we wait until, late February or March to handle some of this, we leave businesses with an awful lot of uncertainty, economic developers with an awful lot of uncertainty, and there's just really no reason to do that. Now, I do think you correctly point out, and I think you saw this really bear itself out in the last days of the session, the last session was, the Senate was ready to go. I mean, we had a special order calendar that had Senator Orr's liability bill on it, had my education funding bill on it, had the PPP loan forgiveness, the tax issue, that taken care of. I mean, we had a bunch of bills ready to go to the House, and they simply were not interested in taking them up. And I haven't heard anything from the House that indicates that they are interested in taking them up now either.
Yeah, well, they'll tell you, you have members that are, possibly vulnerable to the virus. We don't need to bring them in. And then McCutcheon and the other leadership in the House will tell you that the House is different because it's just you got more people all in one space at one time and at the Senate. But I'm a little skeptical of that explanation. I wonder if there's a fear that perhaps from the governor's office, they really are worried about the legislature coming after some of those executive powers.
I think that's exactly what's going on. I mean, if you look at what needs to be done, the four or five different pieces of legislation that need to be handled in a special, they will enjoy wide support in order to get them done. There's no reason, no obstacle that I'm aware of to keep those four or five issues from happening. You got to start asking yourself, okay, then why are we not doing this? And I think you just hit the nail on the head. The governor does not want the legislature in town, probably more specifically doesn't want the Senate in town, because they are very much afraid of what is going to happen when the Senate gets back, maybe taking up Senator Tom Watley's bill that deals with the limits on executive powers, deals with the state health officer. You could see a conversation about maybe some prisons and the governor's authority to enter into long-term leases on prisons, those types of things that are something the governor just doesn't want to talk about right now. The problem is we're coming back at some point.
Right.
And those issues are going to come up. Let's go ahead and address these other issues that need to be taken up and not hide behind whatever we're hiding behind today.
I mean, you raise an important point. I was about to make this point, too, that eventually you guys will be back in Montgomery. At some point, they will have to confront this discussion. So it seems like it would behoove them to go ahead and, maybe we're not going to address this in the special session, but there just doesn't seem to – they're not even willing to have a conversation about, we think the legislature should have input on this and this and this. It seems to me I don't even know this, but it just seems as if it's a non-starter for those guys.
Well, and it is. It is a unilateral, go-it-alone approach that the administration seems perfectly happy with, and I think that's going to cause problems down the road. We saw that last session. We saw lots of hurt feelings. We saw lots of conflict. And look, there's supposed to be checks and balances, but they don't have to, the relationship doesn't have to be what it's turned into now. And that's really, really unfortunate. I mean, when we're all of this, you got a governor and super majorities that are of the same party, we really ought to be rowing this boat together, pulling on the same oar. And that is not what's happening. Instead, you've got an executive who is perfectly happy making those decisions on their own without input from the legislature, and that is really unfortunate.
I mean, overall, this thing could get real ugly real fast between the legislature and the governor. We started out this quadrennium, everybody was on the same page. You got the Rebuild Alabama Act taken care of, really, I thought, in a masterful way by this governor. But this could get off the rails with everything, with prisons, liability immunity. You go through the things that haven't been done yet that got to be done. We're still talking about the possibility of medical marijuana and things like that as well. With everybody having their priority, this thing could get off the rails real quick if there doesn't seem to be like there's a game plan, at least heading into the end of the year.
Absolutely. And let's let's look down the, you know, down the path just a little bit farther as well. You know, I ran for this office to be impactful. I am interested in getting things done and making a change and making a difference. The voters are interested in us getting things done too. And what's going to happen is this is going to bleed over into February, March. From a COVID standpoint, I'm wondering what the difference is between next month and February, March. Is the 2021 session going to be, you know, very truncated as well? You've been around politics long enough to know that the following session is going to be, mostly nothing because it's an election year, right? You know, it's the budgets right. and very simple, non-controversial bills and go home and run for re-election. The problem is we're going to be running for re-election and not have a whole lot to show for it if we're not careful. And I think that the voters are going to hold their representatives and their senators responsible for that and the governor responsible for that. The people of Alabama are back at work. Their kids are back in school in a lot of instances. They are in Baldwin County. It's time for the Alabama legislature to deal with the issues that were unresolved from last year and absolutely to get back to work for the people of Alabama for next session.
Right. And it goes to that whole centralization of power. That's what ought to worry a lot of people. Is when you don't have that, you know, traditionally in Alabama, the governor hasn't been as powerful of an office as it is in other states, and we kind of like it that way. But if the governor continues to keep the legislature out of the game and do what she does, then you're really, that power does kind of go to the executive.
Well, and I think that is largely something that the governor's staff has steered her in that direction, and really, they're posturing for that. You see that with state agencies like ALDOT and others that say, look, this is our way or the highway. We saw the toll bridge down here. You know, that was, we're going to do what we want to do. We're going to stack a toll authority with nothing but members of my staff so that, you know, there are no other voices in the room. We're not going to have a toll meeting down here. It's not, you know, even though we're going to put the bridge down here, we're not going to actually come in and talk to the public about it. It was really, really frustrating, and I think that is the posture of this administration, and I think it's going to cause long-term problems for them for the balance of her term.
And you know, not to refight the toll bridge fiasco, but I think they thought that no one was paying attention outside of, you know, anything south of the Dolly Parton Bridge there, that they could keep that issue really just a extreme southwest Alabama issue, and no one else in the state would care. And as long as they were able to do that, they would be able to get this toll bridge in place, and that's all it took. And it would come at a cost, obviously, to the people down here. They weren't that quite successful. You got to credit to these local officials for figuring out the tip and the metropolitan planning stuff, but politically, that doesn't sound like the kind of government that people in this state really think of when you think of a conservative Republican system of governance.
Absolutely not. You are correct. I mean, that type of centralized power is something that we frown on in the Republican Party. We like local government more than we like centralized power. And you see what the results of that are, right? ALDOT went into that project. And not to belabor this project, I'm sure your listeners are tired of hearing about it, but it went into that project with almost universal opposition from every elected official, local elected official. Now, how in the world do you make a project like that go? You just don't. But to think that you were was clearly folly, and as a former chairman of the Metropolitan Planning Organization down here, you know, certainly met with those members before that meeting, and we certainly discussed the actions taken. I just wish that through some cooperation and understanding and conversation with the governor's office, that project could have had a very, very different outcome.
It's a fascinating dynamic. It's not just the toll bridge, but ALDOT in general. And we're always been told, look, you really don't want to politicize roads and all of that, and then it gets ugly. But, I mean, you don't really want to politicize anything, but you kind of have to. It's our system. And it's not just here in Mobile, but you know, I was in Huntsville, and every part of the state seems to have some kind of issue with John Cooper. Maybe with the exception of around Birmingham, they seem to get the benefit of a lot of this. But do we ever get to the point where we say maybe we need to look at kind of the way the Aldott is constructed, the way it runs, the way it makes these decisions as a matter of policy?
Absolutely. Representative Chris Pringle has filed the same bill year after year that sets up a commission as opposed to just the Aldott director being a governmental or governor's appointee. I filed the same bill in the Senate. Again, it was his bill. I just want to be clear about that. But I think it's a good idea and a good concept. You know, of course, the governor, you know, leaned hard on some folks to make sure that bill didn't move. And that happens in the House, and it happened in the Senate last year. Because governors historically have used that type of transportation money as a political tool. And I understand that, but you've got to start wondering, does that really yield to good long-term transportation planning? And the answer is no. And if you don't believe it, let me introduce you to the roadways of Alabama. We can do better, but we need to take a different approach and a different look at how we do long-term planning for transportation needs in the state.
Yeah, and the idea that you could use this as leverage over a district or a member of the legislature, if you don't vote one way, then we're going to take away your state park funding, which happens, but particularly where I think a lot of people just want their state government not to play a big role in their lives, but they would like the state to take care of infrastructure, roads, and bridges so they could get back and forth to work and their kids to school and whatnot. But to use that as leverage, it seems to be a very dangerous precedent. And I know it happens, but it would seem like we would, as a citizenry, a voting public, would want to go in an opposite direction from that.
Absolutely. And while it's happened in the past, it's usually been something that was subtle. This governor has put a scoreboard in her office with red dots and green dots by it on how you vote on, for instance, the Rebuild Alabama Act, the gas tax, and said, look, you are not getting projects if you don't vote the way I want you to. So there's subtly applying some pressure, and then there is the approach that this governor's taken. You are finding legislators that are chafing under the manner in which and the way in which this governor and her Aldott director act.
I mean, you raise an objection to it, and then you just get kind of laughed at or whatever. This is the way the game is played. This is the way we do it. Maybe we ought to be thinking about that not being the way to do it.
Yeah, I think that if there was ever a time for change and really a catalyst for that change, then this Aldott director and this governor is probably what the catalyst that will get us over the hump is to look at a more stable way of infrastructure planning and funding in the state.
Senator, we got to leave it there, but as always, thank you for coming on. It's always a good way to end a week.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate the time, and have a good weekend down here on the coast.
Yeah, and be safe. Getting ready for potential storms coming our way.
Absolutely.
That was State Senator Chris Elliott here on the program. It's kind of funny the way we do roads and bridges in this state. But we'll talk about that a little bit on the other side when we close out the show. This is the Jeff Poore Show at FM Talk 106.5.
I'll find a place to rest my spirit if I can. Perhaps I may become a highwayman again. Or I may simply be a single drop of rain. But I...
Folks said that I would change my mind. I'd straighten up and do just fine. Ah, but I still love rock and roll.
And welcome back to the Jeff Poore Show on FM Talk 106.5, 54 minutes after the hour. Coming up Monday on the program, our President CEO of the Baldwin County Economic Development Alliance, Lee Lawson, will join us in studio. We also got Dale Jackson from WVNN, my old stomping ground, State Representative Brett Easterbrook. We're going to talk about that Aldott situation and getting 45 four-lane. That's been a big thing for him, but we'll talk more about Aldott just a second here. And Congressman Bradley Byrne will also join us. We'll get caught up on the the Postal Service weekend, Nancy Pelosi calling the children back into school for purposes of this must-do relief for the Postal Service, which, you know, you woke up this morning and you look around and you said, man, everything would be perfect in my life if I just could get to that post office, right? And I knew the post office was shored up. Forget everything else. Forget having to wear that silly mask. Forget the traffic. Forget civil unrest in the streets of America. It's that damn post office we got to get straightened out. But that's the way that's the approach the Democrat-led House of Representatives is taking. We had Senator Chris Elliott in the last segment. We're talking about how the governors in this state have used roads and bridges as a political tool. And shouldn't we be thinking about, you know, taking that mitigating that subway where you can't have a circumstance like this? When I was up in Huntsville, well, this happened before I got to Huntsville. We had a state senator up there, Bill Holzkahl, a very outspoken opponent of then Governor Robert Bentley, and went as far, he wanted to get the 565 connector to connect to Interstate 65. To Huntsville. Huntsville is about 20, 25 miles to the east of 65. When they built 65, for whatever reason, they built it between Birmingham and Nashville. It didn't go through Huntsville. They didn't think it was big enough to do that. So what they did is Huntsville grew. They built an interstate spur from 65 to Huntsville. Well, it's this rickety kind of four-lane highway, and it's a lot better than what things used to be, but there's always been this push to get that widened, and it's the cost of doing it is like a rounding error on the bridge here in Mobile. So the two are not even comparable. But Aldott, the governor, would always use that, hold that over the members' heads in the legislature to get them to do things for them, to get them to vote on certain things. They would use that in other road projects. And Holzkahl cried out about that. He criticized it. Then they started taking other road projects away within his district, which led him to just getting frustrated with the whole system. And then we got a new state senator up there, Tom Butler. But it's that those situations we shouldn't have in Alabama. And the power of the director of Aldott, I think it's if Alabama has a deep state. If there is a deep state in Alabama government, it's the Alabama Department of Transportation, because they are able to get things done that have nothing to do with roads and bridges. They're able, at the behest of the governor, be threatened funding for other things to get what they want. Well, you don't want to vote on this, we'll take this away from you. So we really ought to, I think they ought to really look at breaking that up. I don't know. This is probably something that this legislature may not be able to handle. It may be for a future quadrennium. But you can't have a one all-powerful being in a bureaucracy like that. It just seems very very anti-conservative government that we strive for here in Alabama. Folks, I got to get out of here. Hope everyone has a safe weekend. And we'll do it all again on Monday. This has been the Jeff Poore Show on FM Talk 106.5.